The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from Wright Memorial Public Library, Clark County Public Library, Tipp City Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Washington Centerville Public Library.
Good morning. Welcome to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and on the program this morning, we're going to remember Coleman Barks, who died recently. This is from his obituary in the New York Times. One day in 1976, the poet Robert Bly handed his close friend Coleman Barks an old translation of several works by Rumi, the 13th century Persian writer, encouraging him to render them in modern free verse. "Release the poems from their cages," Mr. Bly said. Mr. Barks, though a poet himself, was an unlikely choice for this task. Tennessee-born and bred, he did not know a word of Persian. He taught English at the University of Georgia and had begun to build a reputation as a Southern writer in the vein of James Dickey and Charles Wright. He set Rumi aside. But a year later, he had a dream. In it, a man sat cross-legged on a cliff surrounded by a warm light. Not long after, Mr. Barks said, he met that same man, a Sufi mystic named Muhammad Rahim Bawa Muhaladin, at a gathering in Philadelphia. Mr. Barks took that encounter as a sign. Over the subsequent decades, he produced more than a dozen books of Rumi's poetry, taking older English-Persian translations and reworking the language and meaning for a modern readership. Thanks in large part to Mr. Barks, who died on February 23rd at 88, Rumi is now one of the best-selling poets in America. Some 750 years after his death, Mr. Barks' renditions of his poems in books like The Essential Rumi have sold more than 1 million copies. Quotes from Barks as Rumi appear on Valentine's Day cards, throw pillows, and inspirational posters. Let's listen now to my 2003 interview with the amazing Coleman Barks.
Who is Coleman Barks?
You'll have to ask somebody else about that.
How did the two of you become acquainted?
Well, that's a story I've told in several places. It involves mystical precognitive dreams. Is that okay for Ohio?
That works.
Okay. In 1976, Robert Bly, the poet, has a conference every year in June, and that year, he had read some of the scholarly translations of Jalal ad-Din Rumi, and he gave me one of those copies of the scholars' renditions of Rumi, and he said, these poems need to be released from their cages. And so I began working on rephrasing A.J. Arbery's English, and just as a kind of a practice every day after I'd get through finish teaching class, I would go down to the Bluebird Cafe and have some hot tea rephrase these poems. And I loved the way the feel of the sense of freedom and the sense of longing in those poems. It felt like something new arriving in my life, and like a whole company of people I hadn't known, you know. Anyway, so I did that, and then as I was doing that, I inexplicably sent some of them to a friend of mine who was teaching law in Rutgers Camden Law School in outside of Philadelphia, and he read them to his torts class, and this man came up out of the class and said, who did those poems? And Milner Ball told him my name, and so that man, Jonathan Granoff, began writing to me, telling me about a teacher. But before that happened, I had this dream on May the 2nd, 1977, of I was there sleeping out in above the river, above the Tennessee River where I grew up, and in the dream I was. Is this going on too long, Vic?
No, I love this part.
Okay. And I woke up inside the dream, although I was still asleep, but I was awake in a different way. And this ball of light came over me and clarified from the inside out. And there was a man sitting there, and he raised his head, and he said, "I love you." And I said, "I love you, too." And the whole landscape there where I grew up just became drenched or soaked with dew. And the dew somehow was love. Mm. And, I mean, I knew that process of formation somehow. You know how you feel in dreams sometimes. And so that was the encounter with the Sufi master. A year and a half later, I went into his room there in Philadelphia and met him, and I realized he was the one in the dream. And he would come and teach me in dreams. You know, of course I can't prove this, but I can't deny to myself that it happened, because it did. And I keep a dream notebook, and there it is. And I'm a ferocious doubter, mm-hmm. of all things. And if I don't have an experience of it, I don't believe it. But this has been my experience, and so I have to. I'm stuck with it. And so anyway, he used to teach me in dreams, and somehow I don't know who these beings are. I used to think everybody was pretty much on the same level, but it's not true. There are some who have reached places that I'm not, that I can't go. Mm-hmm. I can't visit you in your dreams that I know of. And
well, actually, you did last night, but we won't okay. get into that.
Yeah.
I guess reading your book late into the night, you did pay a visit, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I hope I behaved myself.
As well as you are now.
Okay.
So this was Bawa?
This was Bawa Buhayuddin, my teacher for 9 years before, and then he's come to me after he's died, too, in dreams. But there's one other strand to this story that I like to tell, and because it also is true, is that I grew up in Chattanooga at this boys' school, and when I was 6 years old, I became a geography freak, and I memorized all the capitals of all the countries in the Rand McNally 1943 Atlas. And I just loved globes and maps and things. And as we would go across to dinner or lunch, at the dining hall, people would test out this expertise I had. They would call out names of countries, and I would call back the capital, and they would yell out Uruguay, and I would yell back Montevideo,
mm-hmm.
and so on. They would yell Bulgaria, and I would yell Sofia. And my first ecstatic teacher, I had several, was a Latin teacher, James Pennington, at that school. Seems like Latin teachers often are ecstatics. I'm not sure why. Maybe because their language is dead.
Oh.
But they have to rev up a little bit.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, he went down and got a capital out of a country that didn't seem to have a capital on his map. And he yelled across the quadrangle, he yelled, "Cappadocia!" And he said the look on my face as I went through the computer of my brain and sounded like a country, but there was no country. There was no capital. And so he said the look on my face named me. Mm-hmm. So I was called Cappadocia there on that hill. Mm-hmm. And there are still people in Chattanooga who call me Cap or Cappadocia.
Yeah.
And so I've, a few years ago, I realized that the capital of Cappadocia was Iconium or Konya, where Rumi lived and is buried. And
this is not a coincidence.
I take it not to be a coincidence, mm-hmm. but a synchronicity that mm-hmm. somehow there's some intelligence we're swimming within, and it plays jokes on us every now and then. And either we get the joke or not, but I'm glad that I got this joke.
Mm-hmm.
You could call it could be a coincidence, maybe it is, but I don't think so. It feels more like some playfulness on the part that I am named, you understand, for my ignorance.
Mm-hmm.
And it's what I don't know that is central to me. This is Jalaluddin Rumi, 13th century. Every war and every conflict between human beings has happened because of some disagreement about names. It's such an unnecessary foolishness, because just beyond the arguing, There's a long table of companionship set and waiting for us to sit down. What is praised is one, so the praise is one too. Many jugs being poured into a huge basin. All religions, all this singing, one song. The differences are just illusion and vanity. Sunlight looks slightly different on this wall than it does on that wall, and a lot different on this other one, but it is still one light. We have borrowed these clothes, these time and space personalities, from a light. And when we praise, we're pouring them back in.
These poems never had names, did they?
Oh, they don't have titles. Yeah, that's right. In the Persian tradition, they don't give them titles. They just throw them spontaneously into the air. And they move without definition. That's part of the wonder of the ghazal, is that it leaps about and can't quite be held down, really, with a title. It moves very electrically and spontaneously from stanza to stanza.
We are remembering the poet Coleman Barks on the Book Nook this morning. Coleman Barks died on February 23rd. He was 88 years old. You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, sharing community voices through inspired storytelling. We'll bring you the second half of that interview right after this. The Best of the Book Nook continues on WYSO. We remember Coleman Barks, who died recently. He made one appearance on the program back in 2003. Let's listen.
Reading these works gave me a sense of hope, because out of a lot of this poetry, I got the feeling that despite all the madness that I might perceive, maybe something good will come out of it.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I hope so, that there can be bridges built. Of course there can, between different civilizations and different religions. We are mostly family, I think, if we can just connect on that way, on that level. And it's an interesting fact now that the most read poet on the radio in Afghanistan is Jalaluddin Rumi, and the best-selling poet in the United States now is this 13th-century poet, Rumi. Nobody keeps much record on the best-selling poet. There's not a chart for that, but he has the numbers to be ranked up there. Yeah.
How were his works preserved? How did they come down to us?
They were taken down by, he spoke them spontaneously, and scribes took them down as he spoke them, and then he would go back evidently and revise some, but not a lot. And so we have these handwritten manuscripts. This was before the printing press, of course. And they're preserved mostly in manuscripts from the 14th century, from a century after he lived. I don't think we have one from his lifetime. I may be wrong on that. But anyway, I work with scholars who speak the Persian language, Farsi, and who know more about those manuscripts than I do. But that's the way it was preserved. And he is known all over that region as almost like the Shakespeare, the great master of language, which is evidently is very elegant and at the same time colloquial, you know, like Shakespeare. He can reach all from the intelligentsia to the street, all the way. And so he has a great range of appeal in his own tongue, and that is, he sounds like he's available to all areas of the society.
Half a lifetime ago, back in 1971, You lost both your parents over a short period of time. And after your mom died, your father changed, didn't he?
That's right. There were 55 days, I think, between when my mother died in early May of 1971 and Dad in early June. And I say that in that, what is that section called, A New Life? Is that right? Well, I think it is. Anyway, that I talk about the way his heart opened so totally during that period, and he would just go out walking, you know, just to find people to talk to. And he was totally unjudgmental in that period, and everybody saw his his state of openness. And yeah, it was very beautiful and instructive the way he became that. I'd say he became a baby, came up inside his eyes and looked out. Yeah.
You also have a section that you call Animal Energies.
Yeah.
And I guess if I had to pick any section where I feel like maybe you're making a little editorial comment, this would be the one.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Mm-hmm.
You mean you feel it gets more personal than...
Well, yeah.
Uh-huh.
And just you even sort of beg for forgiveness at the end for being snide and divisive.
Oh, yeah. You can tell every time I beg for forgiveness at the end of a chapter, I may have put a little bit too much of myself in it.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, with Rumi, I have to get out of the way, and maybe I don't quite understand how he's working with the animal energies.
Mm.
He says you've got to transform them. You don't repress them. Evidently, you kill them. You kill the duck of urgency and the rooster of lust and the crow of ownership mania and the peacock of wanting to be famous. You know, all these animal energies that he adores, but if you have to transform them, they come back. But you have to kill them. They come back in transformed shapes.
Well, I keep running into the zebra of absence.
That's right. Now, that's a good one.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you can reach the zebra of absence, then you better just put a bridle on him and ride him. Yeah.
Well, you have this quote in that section where you say, quote, "We Americans have our own deadly-to-life versions of denying the horny animal energies. We lie a lot.
Yeah.
We avoid the intimacy of truth. We make nice, blind to our own rage. When we start bombing, we overdo it and never consider the tremendous collateral damage as another form of terrorism. Very different, but still a terror." Now, that really hit me.
I think that is true, actually. As well-meaning as our military is, and as we are, actually, I think we are well-meaning.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we're after the oil, but maybe we are. But anyway, I think that that our willingness to kill, evidently, we killed 400,000 Iraqis last time,
mm-hmm.
and something like 2 million due to the sanctions. I've heard those numbers anyway. Anyway, if we're these cruise missiles every 5 minutes, you know, surely that's a form of terror. And our willingness to allow the collateral damage that will obviously happen. I want to do anything to avoid blowing people up.
Mm-hmm.
If they were my friends, I would be really motivated, you know. And I guess I'm trying to imagine them as my friends.
Yeah.
And this marvelous country of Iraq, where the great saints of Rabia and Halaj al-Halaj Mansur and Abdul Qadir Jilani are buried, we must be careful about that country and the people in it, because they have given the world great treasures in the form of many things, of the wonderful, life-saving Arabian Nights,
mm-hmm.
the 1001 Arabian Nights that Scheherazade told stories. so the king wouldn't kill. You know, she kept him on those cliffhangers for 1,001 nights. So it's the feminine imagination there embodied in Baghdad. Baghdad means it comes from a word meaning the gift of the Magi. So we better be more careful about what we obliterate and try to know what it is we're bombing before we do it. We never tried to learn what was in Hanoi.
Yeah, and we
don't know now. But we killed 2 to 3 million people there.
Yeah.
And a great mistake, huge mistake. And so we need to admit those mistakes, and we need to be careful before we do anything similar. That's what my... I didn't mean to get into politics here.
Yeah,
maybe
well,
that's not politics. I don't know. Surely everybody wants to preserve human life, but we are awfully willing sometimes to do the long-range missiles without knowing or imagining even where they land.
It takes a lot of dung to heat that bath properly.
I, you know, Vic, I am impressed with your reading of this book. You're coming up with images that are magnificently appropriate.
And you're very kind. It just came to mind.
Yeah.
My guest is Coleman Barks. The book is Rumi, the Book of Love, and he joins us by telephone today from Provincetown. Poems of Ecstasy and Longing. Now, I know you picked that line, right?
Yeah, I did.
Good.
I did, yeah.
Good.
Yeah. They let me do the subtitle.
That's good.
Actually, I like the actual title now, The Book of Love, because I came up through the 1950s with that wonderful old one-hit wonder song of the Monotones out of New Jersey. I wonder whom, who, boom, who wrote the Book of Love. Chapter 1 says you love her with all your heart. You probably know the words to that. And anyway.
I remember the song.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that boom there in the middle, I looked it up, and they say that they were in a garage recording things, and a child hit a ball against the window as they were recording it right at that place where the boom sounds. So that's the child's accidental ball coming against the window. It didn't break it, but they all agreed that the boom had to stay. And so they left it in. And I like that inclusion of the random sound in their boom. And in fact, that's the last word of the book, boom. If you look all the way to the end of the notes. Anyway.
You did that by design?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for letting me in on that one.
Okay.
You write your own poetry, don't you?
I do. Yeah.
What kind of stuff do you write?
Well, I'm looking around here wildly for a book. I don't have one with me. you'd have to. How do you want me to characterize my own poems?
Well,
whimsical and tragic.
Okay.
I don't know.
Okay.
I write about mostly. I was telling Bill Moyers one time. He said, "What's the difference between your poetry and your Rumi work?" He said, "Well," I said, "Well, I have to get out of the way in the Rumi work, and I have to get in my way in my own personal work, which that is, I have to admit to my own shame and my own ecstasy and my own confusion." Mm-hmm. And so that the poems are like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I don't have that many poets on the program. In the last year, I've had Donald Hall and Galway Connell.
Oh, you've had the best there.
But I'm always a little frightened to try to ask them certain questions about their poetry because it seems like you're interfering with the magic somehow.
Too
much analysis.
They're teacherly. Qualities. Well, most poets do teach classes, but we never teach ourselves, you know. At least I don't know one that does. And so, I'm retired from teaching now. I don't think I can give you three major characteristics of my own work, which will all be on the exam.
Okay.
Yeah. Now,
well,
I let somebody else do that. But I have a book called Tent Making I'd like to plug.
Okay.
If you can find it on, you can find it on Amazon.com, my own poetry, and also a book called Club, well, Granddaughter Poems, which I wrote with the help of my 11-year-old granddaughter.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So that's a I love that book.
That sounds like a fun project.
She did a lot of it, and I just took dictation.
Hmm.
She's brilliant, of course. Yeah.
Well, we try to squeeze it out of them by the time they become adults, don't we?
Huh. Well, you don't have to squeeze it out of this one.
I guess I mean
fountain. Yeah.
I guess I mean that as more in shutting off the fountain.
Oh yeah, I hope not, but we probably do.
Yeah.
With all this silly grading that we do, you know, it's one thing that's so clear is that consciousness cannot be calibrated or cannot be quantified. You can't say you can say that my intelligence can do maybe arithmetic better than your intelligence, maybe or maybe not. But it really, the qualities of human beings are unique, and our strengths and our weaknesses are just a magical blend. And there's no reason to say, you know, A, B, C, D.
Mm-hmm.
It's trying to, like, grading puppies, you know. And that's always seemed silly to me, those dog shows. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, that's absurd. This dog is a better dog. And, you know, they're all wonderful. And yeah, so that whole thing of calibrating consciousness is a mistake, I think. I don't know what I would substitute for it.
Maybe a love dog?
A love dog. There you go. Yeah. Maybe we should have that poem.
Let's do that, because we're running out of time, and I think that would be a great way to to close out.
Let's see if I can find it here. I might have that one memorized.
Okay.
One night, a man was crying, Allah, Allah. His lips grew sweet with the praising, until a cynic said so. I have heard you calling out, but have you ever gotten any response? The man had no answer for that. He quit praying and fell into a confused sleep, where he dreamed he saw Hitter, the guide of souls, in a thick green foliage. Why did you stop praising? Because I never heard anything back. This longing you express is the return message. The grief you cry out from draws you toward union. Your pure sadness that wants help is the secret cup. Listen to the moan of a dog for its master. That whining is the connection. There are love dogs no one knows the names of. Give your life to be one of them. One night, a man was crying, Allah, Allah. One night, a woman was crying, Allah, Allah.
Hmm. I like that.
I do, too.
My guest has been Coleman Barks. And it's no accident that that's your last name, is it?
It makes a full sentence, doesn't it? Yeah, they used to say about my father, you know, his headmaster, they used to say, old H.B. Barks, but he doesn't bite. He was a gentle and a kind man. But, yeah, that's right,
yeah.
Like a dog barks.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I hope I aspire to be a love dog.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a wonderful thing to aspire to.
Okay.
The book is Rumi, The Book of Love, Poems of Ecstasy and Longing, and it's really been a pleasure to have you on the program, Coleman.
Thank you, Vic. I'm really impressed with this program.
That was Coleman Barks, my only interview with him. He died in February at the age of 88, and he brought Rumi to a very wide audience. And don't go away. We have one more segment coming up. We're going to remember another writer who died recently. And she was a friend of mine. That's coming up. right after this. The Best of the Book Nook continues on WYSO. I opened the Yellow Springs News this past week and saw that Louisa Lang Owen had died. Back in the 1990s, Louisa approached me here in Yellow Springs, where she lived for years, and asked me if I would read a memoir that she was writing. And I did, and I was very impressed. I suggested she really should try to get it published, and she did. And in 2003, we did an interview for it on WYSO, and I'm getting ready to play you an excerpt from that interview. Louisa died recently on March 3rd, and she had quite a life. She grew up in the former Yugoslavia, and after World War II ended, when she was a little girl, after the Nazis were driven out of the former Yugoslavia, because she was a German speaker, she was put in a concentration camp. And that's what her memoir talked about, Casualty of War, A Childhood Remembered. Let's listen now to Louisa Lang Owen on the Best of the Book Nook.
Fall of 1944, Tito has come into power, and it's retribution time.
Retribution.
German speakers were rounded up. You were forced to leave the village with your mother. They took your mother away, and you had armed guards guarding you in this sheep pen. And during the period that you were there after they took your mother away, you were a very smart little girl. You spoke Serbo-Croatian, and you knew a song in Serbo-Croatian.
Yes.
Tell us about the song and what you did.
Don't ask me to sing it. But I'm trying to be funny. But it is that... When you're in such confinement and you're a child, it takes some time to let go of this idea, you know, that they're just people because you're so afraid of them, you know. And I guess in this time of this confusion, I approached the guards as if they were real. I forgot for a moment that who I was to them. And they were at a fire. They made a fire for themselves, but we couldn't get to it. And it's interesting that they made a fire since the stable had straw in it. I guess they were not afraid of anything. And they would sometimes shoot up in the air, you know, up on the ceiling. And they would sing, and they had some kind of, they passed around bottles.
Schlivovitz.
Schlivovitz. Mm-hmm. And then I had to pee, okay? So, they wouldn't let you out to do that, only in groups. But I guess I thought I would wait around till there was a group that had to go out or whatever I thought. But I got stuck at the fire, and I got engrossed in this love song that somebody sang.
Because you could understand it.
Of course.
Okay.
Yes, and so I caught myself saying that I know... a sad song too, because the love song was sad. And then I think they were a bit shocked that I could speak this language, and I was shocked too that they asked me to come up there. To me, in my mind, it's up. They may have been sitting on some kind of straw things or whatever they were sitting on, crates or something. Those are imagery that I still have. And then I sang this song about a little child, which I inadvertently learned, a little child that lost her mother. And of course, I had just lost my mother, so I suppose I sang it very well. And they then would ask me to come and sing when they were so disposed, you know. But
and they would give you money.
They would give me money.
You were the little girl who could sing a song in Serbo-Croatian.
Yes, and they would give me money. Mm-hmm. And I would have this money, which we were... Our money was taken away. Everything was taken away except this food sack that we had. But So I would give my grandmother this money. So there were these inconsistencies and incongruencies. But what it did for me is that for that little time that I was with them, it seemed to me like I was back at home among our Serb people. So somehow or other, I never quite lost sight of the human aspect of any of them, although sometimes it was difficult to see, very difficult to see. And then, of course, you didn't do that. You didn't force your perception on them. But this, I think, was a very good thing for me. It was the beginning of my being singled out at some time. And maybe for me it was the beginning where I could trust myself in this situation.
Well, it was a good example of your ability to survive.
Right.
And my guest is Louisa Lang Owen. The book is Casualty of War, A Childhood Remembered. In the interest of time, let's fast forward here.
Okay.
You've gotten back together with your mother, and you've been put in this village.
Yes, they kept toting us around to different camps, and we were separated in many, many ways, the children were separated according to age, and so we were not with our mother, although our mother was in the same camp. But we were not allowed to see them and that. But then the big thing came about, and the war was now already over, okay? And they now decided again in October to put us into the concentration camp. Now, I don't want to say that all those other camps were not a concentration camp. If you sleep on the floor and you don't get very little food, but this coming up concentration camp in a village called Rudolfsgnad, that's what it was called when it was a German village of about 4,000 or 5,000 people. It was completely emptied when we got there. It was now called Knichanin, and it was right across the river from Titel, that's what they call it in Serbo-Croatian. And that was the extermination camp or the death camp. And my mother had a chance perhaps to stay because she was sewing for Serb orphans, an orphanage, and she was very good at survival. So she knew how to sew very well. But they wanted to keep her, and perhaps they would have kept me, but not for sure. Nothing was ever sure. That was the law of the game. Nothing was for certain. And so we spent... my mother refused to leave any of her children, or because my cousin was also with us.
Is that Seppi?
Yes, Seppi was with us. And then my aunt, who had a child and whose baby had just died. And my mother had a sort of a streak in her, what's fair, you know, what's fair. They all have to go. We'll all go. If one of us has to go, all of us will go. But... to tell the truth, even those that stayed fared maybe not as badly, but they could be killed any time. And some were later on. I mentioned this man that was beaten to death because he stayed. And so in this, for the sake of time, in this terrible camp, there were 20,000 people in this village, which was occupied by 4,000 or 5,000 before.
In other words, you were packed into the houses.
Packed.
And their strategy was, don't feed them, don't give them water,
right.
Don't give them any firewood. That was
right.
Their strategy. They wanted to starve you to death.
The strategy was very clear to begin with, because they were empty houses, and we were asked to come and get our straw. So we are sleeping on straw to a room like this. Perhaps there would be 10 on this side, 10 on that side, but mostly... In our room was very small, a little cupboard. There were six of us, and there were just room enough to stand up. So the straw was there, but it took them 2 months or so to give us any food. And when they did, it was cornmeal that was floating in water, sometimes salted, sometimes not. So that made the other concentration camps where we got these soups that were bits of potatoes in them or was the wished for thing now. We could see how frivolous we were to complain then among ourselves, because of course there was no complaining there, because there was no one to complain to. In addition to not feeding us, we were not sorted now, so to speak. We were just, because this was a place to come to die, and we were told that this was probably the thing that they wished to do. And now we have to remember when that was, October, the war was over in May, in October of that same year. After the war, so continuously they put us into these camps, and now they really wanted to get rid of us. Sometimes I've wondered why no one knew about this or why no one did anything. But there were fences that were made of wood, but of course people are resourceful, and soon there were no fences. And in other words,
they were using them to keep warm.
Yes, mm-hmm. But then of course, then later there was drought. There was, you know, when the next year, so we.
And if you drank water out of the river, they would kill you.
Yes, uh-huh. And because when there was drought, all the wells dried up. Mm-hmm. These were these wells that every house had a well, and so. Although we were at a river, if they would catch anyone going for water, they, of course, would shoot people. Mm. But we are getting very depressing, don't you think?
Yeah, well, but it is a concentration camp.
Yes,
and you were there until 1948?
Yes. And in other words...
3 years after the war had ended, you were still in a concentration camp. You also have the commandant who walked around with the shotgun, your mother and your relatives asked you to go to him and ask for a job, and he did something extremely cruel to you. He emotionally tortured you, and your memory is so wonderful, and some of these stories are so harrowing. And I had a teacher once who was in a concentration camp, a Nazi camp in Poland, and she was a big lady, and she said when she got out of the camp, she weighed about 60 pounds, and she said that food had a special significance to her for the rest of her life because she didn't have anything to eat in this camp. Do you ever feel guilty that you lived?
I sometimes think I, my mother was, as you could see in the book, very realistic. You know, as she put me into these positions, knowing full well that that anything could happen, but we were already in a position where anything could happen, and she took a chance. You know, she took a chance, and I think she would never say she was guilty that she survived, because she did the best for everyone that she could. But as a child, I think maybe she also always said, the children can't say these things, but they suffered most. And there's something, she would look at my cousins and they says, there's something left behind in each of them. And so I guess a certain kind of insecurity that doesn't allow you to quite believe in any achievement or any power that you might have, maybe that. But, you know, I'm not saying it as if I'm crying about it. I tell you, when I saw this field, when I visited the field that made me... where everybody was buried, where about, you know, so many thousands of people were buried that died of hunger and starvation and disease. That's when I thought, I'm one of them. This is, my cousin wanted me to show him where the house was. We went, you know, in, what, 87, we revisited this concentration camp as if we were almost, we were afraid to go because we thought they would stop us. Of course, nobody would stop us. But when I saw this field, I identified with the dead. And I thought, they can't say anything, I can, you know. So in some sense, I must have some kind of feeling of why did I survive? I never think that those that survived were not as brave or not as even, well, they were not as lucky, but I mean, I never think that when I hear stories, even my own, I always, oh, I was good at this, so I was saved. I hear survivor stories. I was good at doing something, so they didn't kill me. Mm-hmm. But I never think that. I think it's by sheer, I mean, I don't know why some of us survived. And here we are pestering other people about our story. But I think it's very important for those who cannot speak that this should be told because people do try to deny it. And you know what is hardest? The hardest is when other people talk about such things that happened to them and we have to be quiet as if we ourselves have to be denying this happening because it makes one feel that we are not even worthy of note. You know, that somehow it happened to us because as revenge, because we were German and good for us. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And it's a very difficult thing to I identify with people that have suffered such things because I know how that is.
Yeah.
Unlike some people that may count themselves into those who suffered just by their ethnic relationship. They belong to the same group. Mm. But I already belong to those who suffered like this wherever they are by experience. I'm related to them by experience. And then I have to be, pushed out of even that community because of my ethnicity, that makes me into a nothing, you know? And so this feeling to me conquers my guilt of survival. You know what I mean? I mean, or it's maybe parallel with this. I'm allowed to have many feelings, aren't
yes,
I?
Yes, you are. Well, Louisa, we really appreciate your time and an extraordinary book.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for having me come.
And that was Louisa Lang Owen, who died on March 3rd. She was my friend, and we talked about her book, Casualty of War, A Childhood Remembered. We did that interview back in 2003, and after that interview, she was contacted by C-SPAN's Book TV, and they asked if she'd be interested in doing an interview for them. And so she did an event at Books and Company at the old store on Stroop Road in Kettering. And I interviewed her on Book TV. And if you go into the C-SPAN archive, you can find that interview. Just look under Louisa Lang Owen. It's there, the videotape. And she was an amazing woman. This is from her obituary in the Yellow Springs News. She spoke English, German, Serbo-Croatian, and Hungarian languages fluently, and sometimes, as her family remembers, all together in one sentence. She was a storyteller, a creative powerhouse, and fearless in her convictions, able to see well beyond politics and absolutely brilliant in understanding and expressing nuance, whether in life or art. We will miss her every day. And that's an amazing book, Casualty of War. It's still in print. A Childhood Remembered by Louisa Lang Owen. As we remembered Coleman Barks earlier on the program and Louisa just now. For the Best of the Book Nook, I'm Vic McInnes. Tune in tomorrow morning at 10:30 when we'll do an interview with Lori Herzl for her new memoir. about growing up in a big Catholic family in Duluth, Minnesota. 10:30 tomorrow morning.